Hello, my name's Kate Rowles and I'm interviewing you for the Wellcome Trust. So you're taking part in Anthony Gormley's artwork, One Another. The date today is the 19th of September 2009 and the time is 7:15 a.m. If I can please ask you to say your full name, your age and where you come from.
My name is Simon Anthony Craddock. My age is 40 years and 5 days and I've come this morning from Amesbury in Wiltshire.
And how are you today?
I am very tired, but looking forward to this.
Can I ask, what was it that made you apply to be part of One Another?
I saw it online, actually, and then it just occurred to me that turning 40, quite nice, halfway through my life, to sort of start with something a little bit different. So I figured, well, why not? I've never done anything like this whatsoever, and I thought I'll just enter the lottery and see if I get my name pulled out. The ultimate aim was to try and get pulled out for the 14th, which was my birthday at midday when I was born. 5 days later is not a problem.
And when you found out that you had got a place on the fourth plinth, how did you then decide how you were going to spend your hour?
It took me weeks. I've vacillated back and forth between doing something and doing nothing. So it literally took a long, long time. And I didn't talk to anyone else particularly about it. It's my own decision, but it was, there were plenty of options running through my head, really.
And which option did you go for?
Well, two things I'm going to do, really. I've got my camera and I'm going to try and take as many photographs of Trafalgar Square from that viewpoint as I can, with the aim of stitching them together and making an enormous panorama of a plinther's eye view of the world. Well, I've also got a block of Bath stone, which I've had in the garage for a couple of years, my hammer and chisels, and I'm going to start at least sculpting the plinth with me on it, So just something that'll go in the back garden forevermore.
And why did you decide to do this?
Just seemed to be appropriate, really, a bit of living sculpture, doing a living sculpture. I'm a bit of a sarcastic so-and-so, and that seemed to work for me.
And is there significance to the fact that the stone is Bath stone?
None whatsoever. It just came from Bath. But it's I guess, Wiltshire is where I live, and it's just the fairly common building stone in that part of the world.
And how are you feeling now about standing on the fourth plinth now that you're actually here?
A bit numb, actually. I'm not sure if that's the early start or a mixture of trepidation and complete lack of acceptance right now. Ask me in an hour.
And overall, what kind of experience do you think you're hoping to have by taking part in One Another?
I think slightly bizarre. I'm not sure that I'll say much when I'm up there, to be honest. I think it's quite a personal experience being stood that high above London. I mean, it's not that high, but it's still higher than the average person at this point in, certainly at this place in London, higher than I will ever have been before, and a totally unique perspective, really, that only 2,500 other people are going to share. So I think it's hard to sort of quantify exactly how it'll feel or seem different, I suspect, and in a bizarre way. Certainly the people that I've seen coming off of it have come down with huge smiles on their faces, but at the same time, one has just said to me, it's very odd. So I think we'll see how I feel.
When I asked you about why you wanted to take part, the first thing you said was about turning 40. How do you feel about turning 40?
Actually, it doesn't bother me at all. It was more about, I guess I get my midlife crisis out of the way in 1 hour rather than anything else. I still feel 12.
Can I ask you to say a little bit about yourself?
Okay, so I was born in Stevenage in Hertfordshire. I grew up on the Isle of Wight, moved to London, and then left London for Berkshire, following which I've travelled all over the world, spent years living outside in Hungary, South Africa, Hong Kong, China, Japan, and America, where I met my wife, before coming back to the UK a couple of years ago. I work in public relations and marketing, and to be absolutely honest, I have never done anything like this before. I'm always quite used to being behind the camera rather than in front of it. So not that I intend to put on a show or anything like that, but that's probably the least comfortable part of this experience, ironically, given I've spent so much of my time working with the media. Excuse me. I'm as I say, 40 years old. I have a brother, Timothy, who lives in Manchester. My mother still lives on the Isle of Wight. My father unfortunately died a couple of years ago. My wife is expecting our first child in January, who will potentially have a Zulu middle name, because we've got married in South Africa. I spent a lot of time in Zululand when I lived in South Africa and was given a Zulu name, which is Awelema, by the tribe out there that I spent a lot of time with. So we figure we might as well honour them with giving our child a middle name that represents that culture. And partly also because when we got married, it was absolutely dreadful weather and it was pouring with rain. And we didn't think at the time that we were going to be able to have children. And the reverend who married us said that the rain was a Zulu blessing. So we figured that was some kind of message and we might as well follow it through to its ultimate end. Other than that, I live a fairly boring, mundane life, really. My hobbies and passions include Lawrence of Arabia and collecting information about him, books, letters, all sorts of things, really. I drive a Lotus 7, actually a Caterham 7, which I love with a passion. If I could get it up onto the plinth, I would, but I don't think I could carry it, even if it is only 500 kilos. Fundamentally, that's me in a nutshell, which is really boring, isn't it? 5 minutes and I can capture my life.
What was it like getting married in South Africa? What was the ceremony like?
It was short. I wish I could tell you I remembered it. The one thing I do remember was one of the ladies from the hotel where we got married got very excited, throwing the confetti in the air, failing to realise that at the same time as releasing the confetti, she released her phone, which flew 6 feet up in the air and crashed to earth and shattered. I don't think she'll ever forget our wedding either. Other than that, the rain. it was, as I say, it was somewhere that was quite close to my heart. Louise's grandmother had lived out there and died out there, so, and she'd never visited, so it was just somewhere to do it that was quite appropriate for both of us, really.
And out of living in all of these different places, is there anywhere that's had a particular influence on you, do you think?
I think they all have. But I would say that, you know, the one overriding element is that I'm very English. I'm not even necessarily British. I'm very English in many ways, because obviously that was my upbringing, and for the first 25 years or so of my life, that was where I was. And the irony is, the more time you spend overseas, perhaps the more you revert to type as some sort of defence against foreign cultures. Now, that doesn't mean that I don't also view myself as an internationalist, because I'm probably more a citizen of the world than I am a citizen of any individual country. But I also recognise the character traits or personality traits that make me English and make me British. And I say English, ironically, because my mother is of Irish stock and descent, so, you know, I'm not even fully English in that sort of genealogical sense, but that's how I would classify myself.
And what was it like growing up on the Isle of Wight?
It was lovely. It was halcyon days, very safe place, no crime to speak of, no trouble. We could play outside. We ran amok, really, in nature's garden. So spending all our time blowing up cowpats, damming streams. It was all very swallows and Amazons. Mm-hmm. Fantastic place to grow up, actually. But limiting when it comes to work, sadly. So, you know, having said that, a number of my friends from those days who left the island subsequently have gone back. And I think it's the sort of place that does draw you back once, you know, you don't ever necessarily really leave it. Mm-hmm. Certainly whenever I go back, it is going home.
And what was your route into your field of work?
I failed all my A-levels. So clearing was an option. And I'd applied for this degree course. And I don't know why they took me, to be honest, because I hadn't done as well as I anticipated, really, or as well as had been anticipated at A-level. And I knew nothing about the field at all, and I somehow managed to blag my way on. Maybe that's what actually suits me for a career in PR is the ability to blag myself into anything just through the power of talking. And I started the degree and actually did quite enjoy it, because it was at that time a very new thing to do. And I started work 3 days after my final exam. Never looked back.
And how do you enjoy your career?
I used to enjoy it a lot. It's become a little bit harder to quantify enjoyment in a way, because you do start, no matter how often you say that everything is new, the reality is that you do start repeating yourself, and you do find you come up against the same problems and issues relating to other people, usually, because it is a people-focused business. It's not necessarily what I see myself doing till the end of my working life. What I will be doing, having said that, is complete unknown to me right now. So you never know, I might get an epiphany moment up on the plinth and decide that I'm going to go off and, I don't know, open a kite shop or something for the rest of my working life. But it's been very good to me as a career. I think actually that's part of the problem. I've perhaps been a little spoiled. I've travelled the world, you know, and enjoyed doing that. Coming back to the UK is a pleasure, because it's always home and it's nice to be home. But at the same time, you know, those I'm not necessarily going to redo what I did before, and therefore it's perhaps time to look at moving on.
Was it through your work that you travelled?
Yes, always. I went overseas with various companies, stayed overseas with other companies. And even personal travel, obviously, was while I was there. So, you know, I've visited about 85 countries, but that's all been as a result of being local. So when I lived in Japan or China or Hong Kong, I was obviously able to do most of Asia from there rather than having to fly from the UK. So it just made, as I like to say, I went on a 12-year holiday at somebody else's expense, really.
And you mentioned living with a tribe for a time. Can I ask you to say a bit about them?
Well, I didn't live with them. I spent a lot of time with them when I was in KwaZulu. Basically, I don't know why I was so interested in it, to be honest, but it's, you know, maybe it's this warlike English nature thing, but I was very interested by the Anglo-Zulu War. So I ended up spending a lot of time at Isandlwana and Rorke's Drift, which you'll all know, obviously, from the film Zulu, and Zulu Dawn, if you've ever seen that, is about Isandlwana. And they're still in the heart of Zululand. There's no real electricity there. There is at the schools and there is at the hotels, such as they are, that are there. There's one lodge that I've stayed in a fair few times. But to be honest, most people go to bed when it gets dark and they get up when it's light. They bring up cattle, and they live and die in the same village as their ancestors. So what's so interesting about it from my point of view is that you can actually talk to people who have had oral history passed down to them through generations of the family, and we're only talking 130 years since Rorke's Drift, for instance. So, you know, two or three generations hence, and you're getting information from the people who are actually there. So from a historical point of view, it's fascinating, but also from a cultural point of view, I think the thing is that language apart, we have a fair bit in common, ironically, with them, in that we're both bloody minded and quite independent as races. And we travel, by which I mean that, you know, the English and the British generally are quite good travelers, working overseas, you know, visiting, and obviously in past times conquering and all the rest of it that went with that imperialist phase. Whereas the Zulu are historically a migrant tribe as well, coming from North Africa all the way down to the Horn of Africa, through the Horn of Africa rather, down towards the Cape, to the part where they've eventually settled in the east of the country. So, you know, they still have that slight wanderlust in their blood. So there's a lot of curiosity from them about life outside. And I was speaking to one of them actually about a week and a half ago. I phoned him up right in the middle of nowhere at the lodge where he works. And all he wanted to know about was what the weather like in London and what time was it here. And, you know, the same questions he always asks, to be honest. What time is it here? The time difference doesn't alter that much, but anyway. But, you know, what comes across is the fact that, A, he's incredibly happy to be talking to somebody from a foreign country, and B, he's just so intrigued by it. And I think that's certainly most of my friends, that's exactly how they feel about other countries. So, you know, that may be a simplistic example, but there were plenty more examples, I think, on a personal level where the similarities became quite obvious. Mm. So.
And how did you communicate with the tribe that you
mixture of English and Pidgin Zulu and Pidgin English on their part, body language, neurolinguistic programming, if you believe the experts, is 60-70% of communication. So, you know, the truth is, I've learned and it wasn't just in KwaZulu, it was all over the world, that you can make yourself understood just by facial expressions and whirring of fingers. If you need to get to an airport, making a sound like an aeroplane is as good as knowing the word for airport. So Pidgin English, body language, gestures, oh, and sweets. If you want to communicate with children anywhere, give them sweets. And the adults love sweets too, frankly, in KwaZulu-Natal. They don't have many sweet shops.
And how are you feeling about becoming a father?
Do you know what? I have absolutely no frame of reference for it, so it's almost like it doesn't register. We're trying to sort of carry on as if it's, I guess, almost as if nothing is happening, in a funny sort of way. And when it happens, it happens. I've learned that really that you just, it's better almost to not dress things up and over prepare. Is just accept that something's going to happen, deal with it when it happens, and work out all the problems, quandaries, issues, and deal with the exciting and happy parts at the same time, because you can't necessarily foresee how it's going to work out. So I'm fairly, ambivalent is the wrong word, but I'm not worried about it at all. Hmm. Financially maybe, but not any other way.
And what's important to you at the moment?
God, that's a hard question. Do you know what? Getting back home and going back to bed for a couple of hours, because we're off to Devon this evening for dinner. So that's so I'm going to drive 85 miles home and then another 90 miles down the other way this evening. No, on a serious note, I watch the TV news, and I, because of getting, having lived in all these places and having a slightly perhaps international view of the world, I get very depressed at the way the world is going and how, you know, ironically not about things like Afghanistan and Iraq, because I think there's probably a job that needs to be done there, but more about places like Palestine and Israel and the Middle East in a sort of not necessarily the militaristic aspect right now, but the cultural aspect, where there's a lot of misunderstanding between countries and cultures, and I think ironically or ultimately it probably all boils down to water, oil and money, and people who pursue those things are in my view probably the least to be trusted with the control of those assets. So you know, that it sounds like a terrible highfalutin thing to be concerned about, but and it's got absolutely nothing to do with about to be a father, so I'm not going to sort of pitch that line, but it's more about being a human and a humanist.
Can I ask about how your kind of sort of how your family and friends have responded to your going on the plinth today?
I've had any number of jokes about being Plinth Simon. a lot of them think it's quite mad. I'm not sure if that's anything to do with the time of day, rather than the actual doing it. A lot of them are going to watch it on either online or on TV this morning, I suspect, hoping that I'll do something ridiculous like fall off. My father would have loved it. That's I think what personally I think. My mother thinks the same, but she would have been quite happy to come up and watch actually, but getting her up at 4:30 didn't really seem fair. And my friends generally, as I say, think that I'm a little bit barking. I think in a way they're probably all a bit secretly jealous actually, not because of the limelight, but just because of the gumption to do it, really.
Who were you doing it for?
Oh, for me. Absolutely. I applied. I didn't tell anyone I was applying. I just applied. And then it came through and I had to tell the wife that I'd applied. She thought it was funny, basically. She thinks I'm faintly ridiculous much of the time. But it was... she thought it was very funny, so it did it for me.
And is there anything else that you would like to mention about yourself or about taking part in one another?
Thank you for having me, really. That's about it. Nothing else.
Thank you very much.